Thanks very much, and I just want to say thanks to all you who are staying. I know it's late in the day, and I appreciate you coming to listen to what's going on here. That looks a little funky there, too. Okay, well, at least you can see the map there of Oklahoma, and that little red square is where Oklahoma County is. But I'm actually from, if you can see, Oklahoma City County, so that we have quite a different jurisdiction. We go over into five different counties in Oklahoma, which is always fun when we're trying to determine whose jurisdiction is what. We have about 700 or so square miles to deal with. And also, if you want to get a real relative aspect of where this is, we're about 1,615 miles from where Kevin Durant now plays basketball. And so we're not really happy about that, but we'll get over it. So we're going to talk a little bit about Casper background, just so if you guys are in preparedness, most of you probably heard a lot about Casper, so I'm not going to get into the real nitty-gritty of it. The technique developed by the WHO way back when, 70s and 80s, and then adapted by CDC, and really is Casper is really a toolkit now. And so you guys may know the advantages. It's quick compared to a normal community assessment. It can be done within a couple of days. Or in this instance, which I'm going to talk about, is we try to do it in a day, and so we can see the results of that. It's pretty cheap compared to a standard community assessment. And in this case, I tried to make it even cheaper. And it's very flexible, so we could choose a number of different jurisdictions depending on what the needs be. The data is generalizable. You have to get a certain number of participants in that for it to work, and we can see how successful that was in this case a little bit later. And then all the data is collected at the household level. So I'm going to kind of talk about the techniques that I came up with sort of out of necessity and maybe naivety, but we'll see. So why did I choose to do a Casper? Because I was told to do one. I'm a public health preparedness epidemiologist, and we had a jurisdictional risk assessment, which didn't really have much information in it, and so I was told to improve on that. And so we really were looking to get more information about our vulnerable populations. And so Casper was mentioned, and I thought, that sounds cool, Casper. Well, going further, I really learned that it should be a caper, but that's, I guess, the CDC and their acronyms or whatever. And we didn't have any money because our BP was drained with other stuff. It's also now really being pushed through FEP, and it's part of Capability 1. So, as you may know, standard Casper methodology, you have whatever your jurisdiction is, and we use census block clusters for this. So when I say clusters, I'm really talking about census blocks, which is what we use for our clusters. It can be a different definition, but so that's going to be kind of standard throughout this talk. But you want to select 30 clusters, and this is randomly selected. I learned a lot doing this because no one had any idea what it was. They just said, do Casper, and so I started reading CDC website, and they had a nice little handout or booklet. And before I had realized that they actually had a GIS program to help out with this, I took a number of all the households that we had in Oklahoma County and then tried to put a random number generator to that, and what a waste of time that was. So I kind of feel like in my head, you know, there are results here, but in my head I'm like, what a waste of time for a lot of things that I did, but really what a learning experience, and how much better can I do this in the future, but that's a little bit further on. So you randomly select 30 houses, which then that cluster is now, wherever that house falls within that cluster is now selected. And so I want to thank Amy Schnall for helping us figure out how to do that. Because otherwise it probably wouldn't happen. So this is what our clusters looked like, and that's pretty good. We got 30 of them there, randomly selected. Some of them are larger than others, and usually the larger ones have fewer houses in them, and that's not fun, if any of you guys have done that. The smaller ones are super easy, and So the second stage, sampling, you want to select 7 houses within that, within each cluster. So what do? You go get an estimate of how many households are in each cluster, divide it by 7. Yeah, that's pretty easy. But then you have to go systematically through in the field using a serpentine shape and stick to the right or stick to the left, pick wherever you want to, and then you go count every house, whatever nth house that you're looking at. So as I said, it's all done in the field, and if you're dealing with volunteers, you have to tell them what to do, and then have to explain it again, and then answer all the calls that they have because they weren't listening or they don't look at their little booklet that you provide them, which is normal, from what I understand. And so here we go. This might be a cluster. I think it's our cluster 15. So census block said that there was 360 households in there. Cut off. So it's approximately 51 houses. So every 51st house, you're going to attempt to do a survey there. So that's really systematic, all done in the field. And we're going to talk about a little bit of difference that I have that I came up with, and we'll see how good it was. But as far as the standard methodology preparing, the training, it estimated between, I don't know, half a day to maybe 6 hours, maybe longer in some cases, depending on what the needs are. And I'll discuss this later, but we had a real issue with actually getting volunteers to come out and help do this, because who wants to knock on strangers' doors for a non-emergency just to get some data for this nerd who sits in an office all day? Not really interested. Well, then we have, it's really recommended that you send out messaging ahead of time so they know what's going on. And so it's standard practice is to send it out to everyone that could possibly be selected in that cluster. So for our clusters, we had, 30 clusters, we had approximately 4,200 households that would have need to be notified. So that's not really, when you have no money at all, and then you ask your boss for, can I get like $2,100 for postage? He says no. So we're going to talk about what I came up with, an alternative strategy, and some pros and cons that happened with it, but we're talking about what I did, how I got there. So the first stage is the same. So we used the CDC GIS model, and it ran, and this is what we got, same map here, which is good. Second stage, we're really doing the same thing, but I just got there a little bit differently. So we want to select 7 households within each cluster, and so I still had to divide the number of households, but instead of using census information, I actually used GIS data information from the city of Oklahoma City that I got. We used GIS to select these, so we didn't have to select them in the field, and then we found that pre-selecting these households alleviated the need for training on how to select households, obviously. They're pre-selected. I don't have to tell you, count this. I tell you which address to go to. And I'm going to show you how I did that. So we start with the same map. We add our GIS data. This is from City of Oklahoma City, which is really great. Kind of being new to this job and being new to the position, I met a lot of people, and these are relationships that now we're pretty good friends, and we're dealing with different projects as well. So I was ecstatic when I got this file. I was like, we can do this? It was amazing. And as epidemiologists, we get excited about weird things. So you apply the cluster boundary, this cluster 15, as you can see, and I'll speed it up here. So we selected the households within that cluster. And then here's the cool part, which earlier, I won't go backwards, but earlier, before I knew about this, I sat in my desk and counted 51 houses on the map. And then like half a year later, I realized, well, an idiot. Hey, at least I did it in office instead of someone else doing it in the field and getting confused or whatever. But then I learned out that you can use this mod function in ArcMap, which is pretty cool. You can punch in, hey, I want to divide it by 51 and do it. And lo and behold, here they are, which is great. And then we just take everything else out, and these are the households that we've selected. And with GIS, if you guys have used it, you can just do lots of cool things. So I just put the addresses on there for the surveyor to go out and to collect this information. So the difference is with preparation, we didn't have to do as much training. So we actually got away with doing 2 hours of training. And for you guys who've done real CASPERS and disaster events, you're like, not going to happen in the real world. We'll talk about that later. But within messaging, I was able to save about 95% of costs because I only had to send it out to 210 households. So that was a big deal. And they actually got it. A lot of them said, probably wouldn't answer the door if I didn't get it. But there are some limitations to this, as you probably, you get your real Casper gurus, which is something maybe I'll strive to attain to be. You say, you can probably see all the holes in this, but you can't really use it for a disaster event. In Oklahoma, we get a lot of tornadoes. You can't use GIS data when the house is blown away, right? Okay, so not in that. Maybe in a ice storm, perhaps, you know, we could use it for some disasters, so maybe not all. You also have to have GIS data. And so if the data isn't there, you can't get it. In some of our non-incorporated areas, they don't have household level or houses for GIS data. They can tell you how many households are in their little division, but not any good data. All right. Also, if the data is misclassified, it's not going to work out for you. We had that happen. They said, we're at the Brahms. That's the address you gave us. Well, Brahms is not a residential area. Okay, so I'll skip through this. We went ahead and did it one day, sent out the messaging, and really, really bad completion rate. But also, within lessons learned, don't plan to do a Casper, preparedness Casper, on a Saturday when there's football on. OSU and OU were playing. Both of them won, but who cares? No one came out. No one answered their door for whatever reasons. In rural Oklahoma, don't go to strangers' doors. I wasn't shot. That wasn't pointed at me, but a shotgun was in hand when they came to the door, and that was quite surprising to me. So anyway, future plans, we're looking to, I want to do some, find out a relationship between income and preparedness levels, and I'd like to use EpiInfo. I have 10 really cheap tablets to try it out, to use EpiInfo, and then really leverage more assistance within my own health department and adding more questions that they're interested in so I can get some more volunteers out and get some better volunteers. So thanks to all these folks, and thank you very much.
Okay, thanks all the speakers. If you have a question for any of the speakers, please go up to the microphone there, and then we'll have the speaker come up here to answer your question.
Hi, Eric. I actually had a question about the Casper. So does GIS show if it's an apartment building or multiple residences at the one address?
Oh, yeah. Our data does show it's an apartment building.
Okay.
So if it was selected, the example I showed, none of those were apartment buildings, but if it is, I take it off and give them special instructions.
Oh, okay. Thank you.
Because, yeah, some of them were, and there was counted, and I said, this is counting off, but that's because that apartment had 120 residents there. So, yeah, they
okay.
do.
Nice presentations, everyone. I'm from Chicago. Question for the very first presenter about the urgent care centers over here. I was wondering if you can, even before you get into the work you did with them, how did you actually find these urgent care centers? Like, what lists
yeah.
were you using? How did you even start?
So there were three lists that we compiled. So one of them was from the Department of Health, starting with Ebola, then after Zika, New York City Department of Health. One of them was from the United Healthcare Fund, and another one was from the Northeast Regional Urgent Care Association. And so we had a visiting fellow basically call up the urgent care centers to make sure that they met all the criteria. And also if for some reason we weren't able to get a hold of them on the phone, then we had to, you know, check out their websites. And so it was a lot of work.
Interested in starting to inventory your urgent care, there are, you know, a couple of trade associations. There are some regional urgent care associations, but the Urgent Care Association of America, they do like kind of the most commonly accepted certification process, and they have that available, searchable on their website, so you can at least kind of get a baseline. I think they estimate about 80% penetration for certifications for urgent care, so it's a starting point.
I had a couple questions. I guess for the red sky, I was wondering, and I don't know if I caught it with the mortality and morbidity, so you were tracking patients. So if you had deaths, because you had stated that all information would be coming out of red sky, but how would that track mortality and morbidity, if that occurred.
It's REDCap.
REDCap. Okay, sorry.
Sorry, I'm not sure I understand your question.
Well, because your question was you're tracking patients, and you said any information, but...
Yeah, so we were looking...
Could you either come up or speak up? Thanks.
Let me make sure I actually get your question. So, we were looking to see if people became symptomatic through their monitoring period,
right.
But that still relies on contact from the public health department to that responder.
Right. So you had said something about if anybody wanted information, they would have to come through that system.
Mm-hmm.
So how would you track if, let's say, somebody's followed and then they get hospitalized? I mean, is that, I mean, how are you?
Yeah, I mean, that still relies on, like, an epi or a nurse calling that person and being in touch with them through
their
home.
Okay, so if there was, if let's say a group of people got sick or died, and someone wants to know how many people we're tracking, and then it would be another system that you'd have to use.
Yeah, we'd have to, you know, go to the facility or the provider or something.
But I mean, also to just doing surveillance.
Yeah,
well. Okay.
Yeah. This is just really event specific module.
Tracking
those people that you already know about. How do we keep track of?
And they're healthy, and so if
they start healthy,
they
we hope
healthy,
they stay that way.
So I guess what my question is
yeah.
If they got sick, can you use that system to keep track of them?
We would keep track that they are sick. We would note that in there, but then, you know.
Anything else would be another additional. Kind of
yeah, program. If they became a case or something, that would go into our, you know, NBS system like that.
Okay.
This is just strictly for, like, tracking
patient
the
track.
Monitoring process.
Okay.
Yeah,
all right.
Yeah.
No, great. Thanks.
I have still one more question for you.
Sure.
You know, we know how to define a case through the case definition. How do you define the expose? Because my issue is that. If I visited, for example, South America, I could be exposed for Zika.
Mm-hmm.
If I worked in West Africa, I could be exposed to Ebola. But how would you really track the highly pathogenic influenza when we really know? I remember in our great public health preparedness 10 years ago, we thought that influenza is going to come from Southeast Asia.
Mm-hmm.
We never really even dreamed that it's going to come from our backyard.
Yeah.
So, and it wasn't really highly pathogenic, it was highly infectious. So my issue is that the definition of exposed is very challenging, and if we would put all our eggs in one...
good poultry pun. Thank you. So for this event, I know we missed exposed individuals, especially those people that were not employed by the private industry, USDA, Tennessee Department of Agriculture, people that probably did the most work on the farm. I know we didn't know about all of them. But to really answer your question, we asked, were you on the site where we detected avian influenza in a certain date range? And if
yeah.
you were, we try to get your name, contact information.
No, I think it's a great, great project.
Mm-hmm.
Also, again, in Zika, are we monitoring?
We don't want to track everybody that traveled to a Zika-affected
yeah,
country.
The issue is, again, pregnant women, that's how we monitor the fetus. So my issue is that prophylaxis for highly pathogenic
mm-hmm.
influenza or bird flu, where really we are recommending prophylaxis treatment for those who could have been exposed in various degrees,
mm-hmm.
highly exposed, moderate exposure, probable exposure. So I think, I think this is for the just the minimum necessary is great. Like, it will be helpful for legislators.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
Thank you.
Thanks.
I have a question for the second speaker, and there's been so many today, I don't even know if the person's still here. Are they still here? The one who talked about quality improvement and right. Thank goodness. Okay, so how long from start to finish? I mean, quality improvement is, you know, it's something my health department struggles with,
mm-hmm.
and I don't know if others do, but, you know, is there a pretty strong commitment with, you know, to do quality improvement requires looking back instead of moving on to the next thing as we're all trying to do all the time. Is that really intrinsic in your department?
So I'm going to go back and say, at least for us, when we had the pleasure of dealing with what happened in Ebola and seeing what happened and trying to manage monitoring for recent travelers, and I know there's other people in the room here from Idaho, so feel free to jump in. They figured out that they were going to have to deal with those things again at some point, and it was a lot easier to like sit down and have a conversation about what worked and why it worked or what didn't work and why it didn't work, in some sort of regularly scheduled meeting or address those process updates in a regular fashion, kind of in a preventative fashion, instead of having to deal with those again later. And so that's what we kind of saw when we really started to deal with a lot more case management in Zika virus testing and lab network coordination. We got the buy-in essentially to keep doing that through otherwise regularly scheduled meetings. I think we typically used our EPI lab meetings and EPI program weekly meetings to just say, hey, these changed, here's what we're changing in our processes to keep people apprised of the situation. And so I think that the biggest challenge was getting people's buy-in to stay cognizant of it. And then once we had that, I think we had a pretty good let's do it, because if we don't do it now, we're going to pay for it later.
So one other quick question.
Yeah.
So from start to finish, like, how long did it take to, you know, to do the whole project? I mean.
So we actually thought briefly about doing, like, a cost time estimate of this. But then it came down to, okay, so what's the difference between having, doing quality improvement processes or just maintaining your response protocol and keeping staff trained? And it was really hard to really find the difference there. Like, what is the difference between just keeping everyone apprised of the situation and making sure you're having good communication with your partners? So the quality, if you're talking about the quality measures, those were all things that were included in our tracking mechanism. So we used a lot of Excel spreadsheets, especially early on. So there was always something like date and time that we received initial notification from EPI, or from, I think we had EPI X notifications for Ebola, or date and time notification, or date notification, I think is what we ended up using for Ebola, or for Zika virus, that we received the specimen submission form. So we could use kind of measures that were really already collected with the data we were collecting anyway. Does that answer your question?
Yep.
All right.
Alan Craig, formerly of Tennessee and now at NCRD at CDC. I have a Tennessee question for you, a couple questions. One is, could you tell us more about the backyard flocks and how, I know the ag folks probably did this, but how did you track the backyard flocks and the owners in terms of whether they were sick or not, the chickens or the owners? And then how did you decide where to do that? And then the second question is, if you had people that you couldn't get a hold of, you were following for symptoms, what did you do if you couldn't reach them?
Yeah. So for the backyard flocks, both were less than 50 birds, I believe. And the decision on what to do with the flocks was definitely an agricultural decision. I think both flocks fully recovered. They did not euthanize the backyard flocks. One owner was extremely cooperative. We got her name and phone number. So there are a couple questions there. Surveillance, they were identified through surveillance around the commercial flocks. So there's certain distance, I think 3 kilometers, and then they expanded to a 10-kilometer radius to do the testing. So that's how they were identified. Then there's another backyard owner, and at least one of the commercial farms is really not cooperative with doing anything with the health department. As a last resort, we sent a letter saying, this is why we're trying to contact you. We just want to make sure your health is okay. These are the things to look out for, and here's our contact information to give us a call if anything comes up. So kind of a last resort, but they didn't want to hear from us anymore. Did I get all?
So in terms of the flocks, you picked a certain number of kilometers and looked for all the flocks around that close to the plant?
Yeah, so both USDA and TDA send out field teams, and they do environmental swabbing and actually test the flocks in any flocks that they find. I believe there's a 10-kilometer radius around each positive site.
Okay, great. Thanks.
Yeah, thanks.
For Kentucky. I was just wondering about your EPI rapid response teams and sort of how you built the training. I know you have Doug Thurman there as a CFO, and I was wondering about the, you know, who funds that? Does the FEP money fund that? And, you know, how easily was that to, develop, and do you have a training module and how you got that all off the ground and pays for it?
Well, like I said, it started back, and I was looking for Katie. She's kind of like the coordinator. She must have just stepped out. Pick on her later, but it was started back in the 80s by a few people there at DPH, and then as we got some of the FEP funding in, they used that to really boost it. And I think over the years we've used like Ebola funding and pandemic influenza funding to kind of bump that up. But at this point now, it's really just the health departments, the local health departments see how valuable it is to have those trained individuals. And so they kind of foot the cost to send those people to Frankfurt for that three-day training and to pay for them their time to be there. And a lot of times we have some leftover FET money that we can funnel in to pay for, you know, like their mileage up there and their meals to do that. But, I mean, it's really – and then the state people are kind of, quote-unquote, donating their time to come talk about their particular area. So I don't think it's like a huge thing. I think the biggest thing was getting the health department buy-in, because I know like in my region, they anytime someone retires, it's immediately we need to get them to ERT training if you know to replace that. So I think that there's that buy-in there so that the local health departments are willing to let that nurse out of the clinic where she's billing hours for 3 days so that she can learn how to do this because it's so important. I mean, we've had some major outbreaks where those ERT people have been invaluable to my region, so...
Okay, we're going to end the session now. Thanks to everybody, all the speakers again. Thank you very much.